Cinnamon, where he gonna run to? Cinnamon, where he gonna run to? Where he gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord, all on that day. But the rock cried out, I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I ain't gonna hide you down all on that day. I said, rock, what's the matter with you, rock? Don't you see I need you, rock? Lord, 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 all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling all on that day. So I ran to the Lord.
That's Nina Simone with Sinner Man from her 1965 album, Pastel Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, November the 19th. And the National Guard will add to a heavy police presence planned for the city of Ferguson when the grand jury's decision on whether police officer Darren Wilson is to be prosecuted for killing Michael Brown is announced. Governor Jay Nixon and local officials promise a kinder, gentler militarization. The grand jury's ruling, a determination of Wilson's criminal culpability, formally will conclude the state's inquiry into the contentious August 9th shooting, which touched off weeks of unrest and violent skirmishes between protesters and police. But the state grand jury isn't the only determinant of justice. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder had launched a Department of Justice investigation into Brown's death and a parallel probe into the Ferguson Police Department. Following Monday's discussion on the state grand jury, we focus today on the federal inquiry and whether Ferguson's hope for justice will be delivered by the Department of Justice. Attorney at Law, Alton Maddox Jr., again joins us to discuss the competing interests and conflicts of the state and federal investigations. And Alton, it's great to have you again with us on Lead Stories.
Well, great to hear your voice, Eutrice.
Thank you. Well, we had a little glitch yesterday, but that worked out, and it's been fixed. Now, let's talk about this federal-level investigation. We know that any minute now, we've been talking about this any minute now, the state grand jury, and we discussed that on Monday in great detail. What about this federal investigation supposedly looking at the possible criminal prosecution of Darren Wilson, the police officer in the shooting death of Michael Brown? To your knowledge, is this does this approach in a case like this by the federal government yield any results in terms of criminal indictments?
You know, Eutrice, let me go back a little bit before we move forward, in that many times in our own community, we put the cart before the horse, and that is really unfortunate. And this is how we get waylaid down the road. And, you know, I spend a lot of money every month on a website called www.realestateautomatics.com, trying to give people the clear vision of what we are having to deal with. And I suppose the mere fact that I have to really use my own money on a situation in which I am absolutely only one of many millions of people who are affected by this really shows you exactly where our community is, because there is no real leadership in our community, none. You know, and just today, you know, I was listening to a report from Reverend Al Sharpton, where he's talking about the National Action Network is going to be in all these street cities trying to stop violence. And he's absolutely missed the whole point of what this issue is about. And this is where we are caught up in leadership that is totally illiterate and being led by black selected officials who are unable to read and write. You know, if there was ever a need for a literacy test, it should be done on the people that represent us. You know, we got it all backwards, you know. And so, you know, that's where the problem is, because we are led by absolute buffoons. Now, having said that, I wanted to approach this from the way that you would approach it in a legal matter. And even if you were in law school, you will be asked to put the right steps first. And so it is alarming to me that we have absolutely no black lawyers out here at all who seem to be up to the challenge of what Charles Hamilton Houston said, that black lawyers had to be in the vanguard of the legal revolution. And he was using those terms very liberally. To be in the vanguard of the legal revolution. And we are caught out there now with ambulance chasers and social parasites leading us, you know, and we are caught up where if the family wants to be represented by social parasites and ambulance chasers, that's their business. But this is a class action. And as a action against a particular class, we have a right to demand our own representation aside from what the family is doing. That's all well and good what they're doing. But this is a class action. You know, and very few of us understand these legal terms. And that's the reason why I put on a website, www.realestateautomatics, a pairing of 75 different pairs of words, which will be expanded in the future when I can get back to it. But the answer to the question is this. This is clearly, at this stage, an obligation of the federal government, and more specifically, the obligation of President Barack Obama. So let's not confuse this with the Republicans being in charge of the Senate, or the Republican being in charge of the House of Representatives. This president is speaking about something that is absolutely asinine, where he's talking about he is now prepared at any moment to announce an executive order to protect illegal immigrants, at the same time that the protection of descendants of enslaved Africans is going up in the smoke. I mean, how do you, having gone to law school, don't see the difference between blacks who are supposed to be citizens and illegal immigrants who are absolutely not citizens? And yet you can call for the invocation of an executive order to protect the illegal immigrants, while at the same time, the governor of Missouri is misusing his authority, because there is such a thing called martial law. But martial law can only be used when there is evidence of a breakdown of civil authority. Now, the mere fact that the people of Ferguson is saying simply that we are going to engage in civil disobedience and in exercise of our First Amendment rights is no basis for the governor to have already called out the National Guard. And having done so, the only response that President Barack Obama can now do is what was done with Dwight Eisenhower with the Little Rock Nine, what was done with President Kennedy in the protection of James Hood and Vivian Malone in the University of Alabama integration case, or what FDR used in 1941 to invoke an executive order to make sure that blacks were able to have jobs in the defense industry. So, you know, the problem is just so frightening that none of our people seem to understand all of this. And this is very basic. And when you have to spend all of your money writing and writing and writing and trying to give our people a glimpse of what is going on, and we don't get it from all these writing, all this money that I have to invest in something that should be undertaken by the black community itself, is crazy. And so the problem here, before we even get into whether there should be a civil rights investigation, the first issue is what should be done to stop Governor Jay Nixon from bringing about martial law in Ferguson, Missouri. Because I don't know whether anybody understands this or not, is that this particular situation, what is going on in Ferguson, paved the way for what happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II, because the military got involved in making decisions under a grant of authority by FDR, and they then decided to use that grant of authority to intern the Japanese Americans. And now, I don't know what people understand this, very easily, all of the people of Ferguson could be interned, especially those persons of African ancestry. That's what we're dealing with right now. This is a real crisis. And it's only because of our ignorance, you know, that we can simply sit by and take this in a very lackadaisical fashion.
Well, I'm going to still follow through with this question. The mere fact that we have the federal government coming in, supposedly doing this investigation, its own investigation, with a mind toward a possible criminal prosecution of Darren Wilson, does that bode well in terms of the history of the federal government in indicting under these particular circumstances, where a police officer is charged with killing a civilian? Do you know that this has been quite successful in terms
of judicial history? Well, the only thing you got to do is to answer that question. Of course, I still put my issue on the table because right now that to me seems to be more threatening than the question I'm getting ready to answer. But in response to your question, yes, and you only have to go no further than the Eastern District of New York, which is Brooklyn, New York, and the United States District Court in Brooklyn, to answer your question, because you have two situations there, one in which Limerick Nelson, who had been acquitted of a state prosecution for murder, had to face a federal indictment after being acquitted of the state prosecution for the alleged murder of this rabbi in Brooklyn. And, you know, and therefore, the basis for that civil rights intervention was very questionable because it didn't fit within the civil rights laws, but nonetheless, it happened. So the point being, if we are to follow stare decisis, which is supposed to be the guiding light for litigation, then the answer is yes. This federal government should absolutely be involved. The other point that should be made, though, is that Loretta Lynch, who is the now nominee for the U.S. Attorney General's position, is very familiar with the sodomizing of Abner Louima by members of the police department, where they use a nightstick to cause substantial damage. Now, the reason why, and I think everybody should be very clear about this, the reason why the federal government took over that case had nothing to do with Al Sharpton, the Action Network, or nothing else. It had nothing. And, you know, if he wants to debate that issue with me, I can go on his airways. You know, if he's free to debate, he should invite me on, and I will make it very clear to him what the circumstances were. So anybody who feel like they're supporters of Al Sharpton should pick up the phone and call him and say, look, let's hear this debate between you and Alton Maddox about what really happened there. But the point is that the reason why Charles Hines, who ended up putting more black men behind bars than anything else,
Charles Hines being the district attorney
of
Brooklyn at the time.
The district attorney of Brooklyn, the former special prosecutor in Howard Beach. The reason why Charles Hines did that, because he wanted to establish, along with the federal government, a shoot-to-kill policy nationwide. And the shoot-to-kill policy fits right in with what happened with Michael Brown, because he was assassinated on the public streets. And so as a result of that assassination on the public streets, what you did was you eliminated any witness to the assassination. And secondly, you moved the case from a potential pain and suffering to a wrongful death. And the amount of money that you can collect, the amount of money typically that a black person can collect under a wrongful death action is quite different than the amount of money that can be collected under pain and suffering. However, under pain and suffering, there's obviously a conclusion that there must be survivorship. In other words, you didn't die. So, you know, that prevents the wrongful death. But in the meantime, it allows you to collect a lot more money, which is exactly what happened with Abner Louima. Abner Louima collected probably somewhere around $10 million. In these wrongful death cases, the judgment have been substantially lower because the standard for wrongful death and the standard for pain and suffering are different. And in a pain and suffering case, a black person is likely to receive a lot more money than he would receive under wrongful death.
Well, the question I'm hinting at here is that the very recognition of civil rights prosecutions suggests a duality in the law. Should the federal government intervene, it should be interpreted as a failure, if you will, of the state apparatus. And while people are saying, well, we need a federal investigation, why is there not an insistence that the state process work?
Well, you know, let me go back again, Eutrice, because I'm trying to paint a broader picture so that people can see a lot more than what may be suggested in an answer. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is that the Michael Brown's case involved a state-sponsored public assassination. There is no need in a case that provoked a state-sponsored assassination publicly to move to a grand jury, which is a secret proceeding, because if everything's already public. I mean, so why are you going to a grand jury to cover up what obviously may have happened really in Ferguson? So, you know, the argument would be made for any lawyer with a ticking brain cell is that this is a misuse of the grand jury. Because you got, you know, you have two ways of resolving issues. And what people fail to understand in all of this is that a grand jury is an investigatory body. It has a function, but a preliminary hearing also is a tool that could be employed. So in this situation, there's no need to go to the grand jury in the first place. This
we talked about that on Monday.
Assassination.
Now, you call it a state-sponsored public assassination, but the local prosecutor, with the use of this grand jury, seems to be indicating that this is a combination of departmental hearing. It is a question as to whether the officer acted within departmental guidelines. It is a matter of basically refuting eyewitness accounts. It is a matter even of challenging the independent autopsies that were done. So you categorize it from the perspective of a defense attorney, but this is what is turning out. The purpose of this grand jury is turning out to be determining all these other factors, but not necessarily the huge charge that you just levied here, that this was a state-sponsored assassination of a civilian.
Well, you know, this is the other thing. This is the other factor in the equation that is being left out. And that is assuming everything that you say is true. But we also have to consider the fact that there is a, has always been, and I pointed this out also on the website, www.reinstatealternatives.com. I point out also on that, that Missouri has always had a culture of judicial racism. Always had a culture. And it has popped up in so many different ways. You know, that one of the things that I would advise anybody who was in Ferguson to do is to first begin to examine this culture of judicial racism that still exists. When you consider the fact that you had the case of Lloyd Gaines, one initiated by Charles Hamilton Houston, in which they were able to win on the facts, and then Lloyd Gaines, who was being opposed by the Missouri State Attorney General's office, went missing and has not been seen to this very day, to the fact that you had Negro zones in St. Louis in which blacks were only live in certain areas, to the fact that you had John Ashcroft, who became the Attorney General under Nixon, who was also associated with the Confederate States of America, to the fact now that you have Clarence Thomas, who said that he learned everything he knew from the Missouri State Attorney General's office. So, I mean, and now you have Jay Nixon, who was the Attorney General in that various office, and now you have this clown out there in St. Louis who is managing the grand, or mismanaging the grand jury.
I wanted to ask about this pattern, and it is a disturbing pattern in a way, or maybe it is because I don't understand it, perhaps. But in cases like this, where you see a real duality in the application of law, to my mind, when if Michael Brown were a white person,
mm-hmm.
it would seem to be almost unnecessary to even ponder prosecution civil rights violations here. Why is it that in cases involving people of color, we always get this thing about civil rights prosecutions?
Well, I think, one, that you got to realize that Missouri is the home of Dred Scott. And, you know, and there's a whole lot of history before we got into 1857 and Judge Roger Taney issuing this dictum that no black man has any rights that a white man is bound to respect. But there's a lot of activity going on before that time. And then as a result of that, you ended up with Cecilia, a slave, in which a black woman was hung for defending herself against a white rapist. So, you know, you're dealing with a whole historical understanding here that people really need to go back and fully explore in this case. But you're absolutely right. There is a duality that goes on here, and it would not exist if Michael Brown had been a white young man who had been murdered by anybody, and particularly by a black police officer. That wouldn't be that question. And these are the issues that President Obama has to take his blinders off and address.
What then should the approach have been, in as much as the Department of Justice says it's committed to taking a hard look here at this case?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, the Department of Justice has to first really announce for the first time, because the Justice Department, as I pointed out, and this has to be noted, because everything starts with history. You know, you can't get a clear understanding of anything until you understand its history. The Justice Department was only established in 1870, which is exactly the end of the Reconstruction Amendments. And so it was established not to protect newly free Africans, but was to make sure that they did not get any protections at all. And after that, if you go back and study the history of those persons that were appointed members of heads of the U.S. Justice Department, most of them were outright Confederate sympathizers at best, or they were Confederate operatives at worst. So the history has a culture of racism in it that nobody is addressing. And this is the problem that you have when you don't understand history. And I say this then, I repeat it. A black lawyer, if he is going to be effective in representing black people, has to have the equivalent of a baccalaureate degree in black history, has to have the equivalent of a master's degree in legal history, it has to have the equivalent of a doctorate in military history or military science. I mean, you can't get around that. I mean, you know, and I have written, unfortunately, I don't want to get into this because people called me, but at some point, you know, I can certainly discuss it. But I actually wrote a manual on how to represent a black defender. And that manual had helped me to really be successful, as long as I was successful, in winning the cases that I won. But, you know, when you don't go back and realize that law schools were not developed for the protection of black rights, law school was developed to protect white supremacy and to promote white supremacy. And at the time when the law schools were established, most of us were still in chains. And these law schools never envisioned us of being anything but, quote, slaves, close quote. And so when we started going into the law schools, you know, we just immediately accepted whatever they dished out. You know, it was different for me because I understood a prior history and I was able to connect the dots, think outside the box, and realize that what I was getting in law school was not going to help black people. And that's the reason why my route was quite different than most others, because I ended up actually doing the research to come up with a manual on how you effectively represent black people. And so my point is, you can't ignore this history that has arisen, or the culture in the U.S. Justice Department, and you can't ignore the history that has arisen in the Missouri State Attorney General's office.
Well, I do note as well that the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, was the attorney heading up the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice at the time that Amadou Diallo was killed, and had promised a thorough investigation of that, and nothing came of it. I was the only reporter in the room, allowed in the room, because I went with a group of African chiefs and elders to discuss this issue, and he did commit to investigating this outrageous assassination. Now, that was an assassination of a young man just sitting on the stoop of his own home.
Yeah,
and killed right there in the vestibule with 41 shots fired at him, and 19 of them hitting their mark. The officers were able to walk away from that homicide, that outrageous act, without anything sticking to them. I want to ask about the purview here of the Justice Department that does not seem to be including prosecutorial or judicial or official misconduct.
Well, the problem with this is the notion of a compromise. And, you know, and I wrote about this, about this country being a divided nation, and it's going to continue to be divided by a divided nation because a people in the nation have been fractionalized. And so it permanently will require the whole country to be divided, and that there was a number of compromises before Judge Taney spoke. And then after Judge Taney spoke in Dred Scott, you had the compromise of 1877. Now, you know, people who just read this stuff and act like these people ain't serious. You know, it's like, okay, well, that's in the past. That's what they did back then. But people continue to pass to the future. They don't drop the past. You don't hear them say, well, that was old stuff. No, they go back to the old stuff and say that's the reason why this new stuff has to be the way it is. And this is the reason why we can't function in this society, because our level of thinking is totally different. And so, you know, with them, as they sat there in that room that you were sitting in, they knew then that, hey, wait a minute, our ancestor, the white ancestor, that is, came up with the Compromise 1877. And the Compromise 1877 withdrew federal protection from enslaved Africans. That was the compromise. And the people that took place in that compromise were Rufus Hayes of Ohio and Samuel Tilden of New York, the former governor of New York, who represented the Confederate States of America, which is why we are still in the condition that we are in here in New York, and which is why the Ku Klux Klan had its headquarters in Manhattan at the Chelsea Hotel. I mean, this is all real. And so we have to go back and examine all of this to begin to understand why the U.S. Justice Department is a fake and a fraud, because it is masquerading as being the guardian of liberty and all of that. And at the same time, it is adhering to the Compromise of 1877.
When this grand jury announces its verdict, I shouldn't say its verdict, its decision, but it actually is a verdict because the prosecutor has been conducting a trial under the guise of a grand jury investigation. But when the decision is made clear, what should in the interest of the community, what should happen in terms of a legal challenge? Either way that the decision comes down.
Okay, well, you know, and this is why, you know, if I had the time, Eutrice, I could literally write a textbook in this entire area, as I at once did with this manual on how to represent the black defendant. And the textbook would arise out of my own experiences, because basically whatever is going on here, you know, I have experienced in other matters, you know, like the grand jury leaks that happened out in Ferguson. Well, I experienced that with the Tawana Brawley case, you know. And now you're talking about what happens when the grand jury returns with a no true bill. And the question will become, what happens next? And what we did in the Michael Stewart case, in a case in which Lewis Clayton Jones and Michael Warren asked me to become involved in, we acted as though that never happened and continued to demand and force the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to not only indict the second time around, but to force a complete trial all the way up to a jury. So, you know, I mean, whatever happened after that, you know, was what was beyond us. But you had a complete jury trial, and you had people who could absolutely now, as opposed to a grand jury proceeding, which is secret, could actually see what was happening and the kind of evidence that is being presented. So my point is, I think that what black people really needs to do is to have a reorganization plan. That's what this boils down to, a reorganization plan in the same way that they're reorganizing Detroit, in the same way they are reorganizing Jefferson County, Alabama, which is, includes Birmingham, that we need a reorganization plan. And in that reorganization plan, I'm absolutely certain that this man would definitely go to trial, and with the kind of energy that is being displayed in Ferguson, he will be convicted.
You're talking about, of course, Darren Wilson.
Yes.
But even now, even before this thing came to trial, and you had pointed out, and I agreed with it, in fact, I have said it myself, that there's very little, if any, indication that African-American lawyers, and especially the lawyers assigned to the family, have been doing some very necessary legal work here, to, even if it's only to say that we have established a record that we object to this, 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 and this. Even if it's just to say that, you know, that...
Right. Yeah, well, there's no question about it, you see. But you see, this is what I believe. I believe that one person can make a difference. That's what I believe. And I've tried to tell the Freedom Party, of which I had formed, not to be as behaving as they are behaving now, because they are behaving now totally contrary to which this Freedom Party was founded, and to ask the United African Movement to behave totally contrary in which it was founded, is to put an all-out force on terms of having me not subject to judicial bullying. Because what people fail to understand or don't want to appreciate or have buried their heads in the sand, I have committed no crimes. I committed no professional unethical acts at all. I mean, anybody could win this case if you have some kind of community support at all. There's no reason why I shouldn't be in Ferguson today. There's no reason why, you know, the information that we have to convey to the people of Ferguson has to be done on your airways instead of having to be out there. This is why what you do is so important, because it guarantees the right of free press, which is the First Amendment right, and which is the cornerstone for the kind of activity that we're talking about engaging in. But there's no reason why you could sit up there as a Freedom Party and you can't demand. You won't even make a demand. A serious demand, or you in the UAM, you won't make a serious demand. It don't take but one organization. You know, that's all just a little guts. And, you know, and that's what frustrates me, is the fact that I can't be out there. It frustrates me further that people make sure that any money that should be going to me does not go to me and go to the United African Movement or somewhere, Freedom Party or somewhere else, to make sure nothing going to happen. This is what is bothersome, because we're on the verge of going back into concentration camps. And somebody needs to be able to bring it to our attention. And this is really why I'm so fortunate, and the rest of us are so fortunate, that we can have this dialogue today on your program, even though you had to go out into space in order to connect us up as a community.
Well, let's come back to this the mobilization and the militarization of force in anticipation of the community's reaction to what most people are anticipating would be a no indictment of Darren Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This speaks to, again, directly to the authority of the U.S. Attorney General. This should have been a question asked about, well, why? Why did you declare a state of emergency ahead of a scenario where we don't know what the reaction would be? Why would you abuse or choose to abuse the authority given you as governor in order to do that?
Right. And
why is it that we have, you know, nothing happening in terms of, this is why I was asking about the role of the Justice Department in looking at prosecutorial misconduct, official misconduct, and judicial misconduct.
Right. And you know, and see what's good. I hope people might be able to capitalize this. The first thing you raised is, why is this action that Nixon is announcing now is premature? Because it has to follow something. It doesn't precede something. You know, so even if you talk about invoking military law and martial law, you're talking about it following something, not preceding it. So, you know, it's like prior restraint. If you go into court and say that somebody is getting ready to do something, the judge would tell you, I cannot issue an injunction because you're talking about prior restraint. And prior restraint is totally foreign to what we do. All right? So, you know, here we're talking about prior restraint of the exercise of constitutional liberties before anything has ever happened. That's the first issue that the Justice Department should be very much aware of. The second issue that they should be aware of, in addition to the question that you raise, is even if you decide that it is appropriate to invoke martial law, then why are you using a standing army to deny people their constitutional protections? Because, you see, the militarization of a police operation automatically is defined as a standing army. And for this is why I tell people that you got to not only know a black history, but then you have to know legal history. And when you know legal history, you understand that the notion of a standing army was condemned in this country. Nobody's talking about that, though. You know, so we have to get our news and information from MSNBC and CNN, when in fact, you know, we should be using our own thinking caps and employing history as our guide to reach the appropriate decisions that have to be made. So, you're talking about a premature action, and then you're talking about the use of a standing army to deny people their constitutional rights.
So let's check, from your perspective, the order of legal priorities here. What do you see that as?
Well, my order of legal priorities is the same as Charles Hamilton Houston. And that order of legal priorities is that black lawyers must be in the vanguard of a legal revolution. Obviously, a legal revolution is taking place at Ferguson, and black lawyers have to be in that vanguard. And our question has to be, where are they? Because we haven't seen them yet. And something is terribly mislaid when you're in a situation where the residents of Ferguson have to be called upon to deal with these intricate arguments that we're talking about now.
So basically, the idea is to have a legal army. Well,
of a black revolution. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is our first thing. See, this you got to understand this. When the United States gets ready to go to war with anybody, the first thing they do is call in lawyers. This is the reason why I introduced the idea of a rules of engagement, because that's what lawyers do. Lawyers come in and outline the rules of engagement, and then things move from there. You know, next you come in with a new terminology, new language, new words to be used. You know, you come out with the whole notion of how do we conduct propaganda and how do we use propaganda. These kind of things follow. But the first step is the black lawyers, in our case, in Ferguson, becoming a legal arm. And we're not talking about ambulance chasers in this regard, you know, because that's all we see out there now. Now, the family has a right to appoint ambulance chasers to represent them. I'm not taking that away from them, but this is a class action. This is not a personal injury action. And so we should be sitting behind Benjamin Crump and Al Sharpton, you know, to deal with our constitutional rights as they are. We should be taking appropriate action and coming up with people who are not ambulance chasers to make sure that those rights are guaranteed.
Why is this a class action suit in your view? Why is this a class action?
Well, this is a class action for this reason, same way that Central Park 7 was a class action, in which I tried to intervene and have the rug put out from under me, because when they found out that I was going to intervene, which would have been in October, they advanced the date to September 6th when they knew that I was going to be in Staten Island dealing with Ramsey Nelson. So, you know, and so all the things I could have gone into court on the 6th of September and demonstrated, first thing being demonstrated to black people who are confused, is that I'm not in any way have been disciplined. I am a legitimate lawyer in any federal matter. And so, you know, that would have put that to rest from these black politicians who are running around talking about, well, I heard that he was disbarred. Ain't nothing to be done about it. No, fool. Didn't you see him on September 6th in court? Didn't nobody arrest him? Then nobody challenged him because they couldn't challenge me. So, you know, this is the first thing that I had wanted. Now, the reason why it's a class action, because there's an action that is being taken against a class. That's why it's a class action. The class is black people. The class is descendants of enslaved Africans, and the action that's being taken by that class is by the Ferguson Police Department and all of the other agencies that have conspired with the Ferguson Police Department to deny us of our rights. That's why this is a class action. This is not a personal injury action. This is the way I tell people, you got to understand those pairing of words that I have on the website now, and I'm going to be expanding, because this is what is confusing us. You know, we don't understand the language. You know, and I just add, Clarence Thomas understand that very well, because Clarence Thomas not only went to Holy Cross to get an education, but he made sure that he majored in English. That's what he majored in. And he realized that whoever realized it, his sponsor realized, the first problem is language. So he couldn't bring that gullah that he was talking on the national scene. They had to deal with the language that he was using. And so he couldn't be effective using gullah. He had to be effective using the English language in an appropriate way. And that's what penalizes people when they get up on the witness stand speaking Ebonics or something else without an interpreter being present. The first person that should have demanded my call for interpreter should have been Clarence Thomas, because I said years ago that black people can't afford and enjoy any constitutional rights unless there's an interpreter present to convey to the jury what they are saying.
Let me ask you, as a class action then, why is this being handled at the state level?
Why is it being handled? Well, because you don't have any lawyers. You don't have any lawyers to make any kind of applications to the courts. You know, you can always have a change of venue, all these other things that are available in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. But if you don't have a lawyer making those kind of applications, that's why you're still in state court.
And it's in state court that we have this menagerie approach occurring. We have the combination, as I said, a departmental hearing. You have supposedly a trial occurring. You have all kinds of rules being bent, and you're not quite sure what kind of grand jury this is and what it's actually supposed to be doing, and therefore the result is going to be just as hazy.
You put it in the most precise language that anybody could use to understand what the predicament of our people are on this date in 2014.
Walton, I just want to bring this here. With this federal investigation, then what are you preparing for in terms of, you know, where this might go?
Well, I think what I'm preparing for is trying to get black people prepared to understand where it might go and how you can address it. I mean, that's the only thing I can do at this moment, because I don't have any supporters here in New York, you know, that would stand behind me. In fact, they'll make sure that nothing happens. So the only thing I can do at this stage is to just sort of try to prepare our people on a program like yours or on any other program that would let me on the air or through my writings as to how we're going to have to deal with this.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We'll continue the conversation because we have to focus specifically on the leadership aspect in this case. So thank you, and we'll continue.
Okay.
Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope this was illuminating and that it added something to your knowledge base about this case and particularly about the issues and how they're being handled. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the infectious myth. No, it's not. It's Economic Update with Jack Rasmus. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. That's my email. And on Facebook, Lead Stories with Hutrice Lead. I want to thank you so much for the outpouring of concern yesterday. But I did post a note on the Facebook page. And so thank you so much, many of you who made those calls. Thank you so much for supporting this program. So many of you are actually ambassadors for the program, getting the word out to your spheres of influence and your circles and telling people that this is a great program to listen to and to be a part of. And PRN is the reason, because it is hosting this program. It is a PRN program. So thank you so much for your continued work. We have quite a few people downloading now, and I think we're up to almost 425,000 downloads. So it means that the program is gaining attention, and it is, I think, largely due to the efforts of listeners who are passing the word. So thank you so much. And we'll see each other tomorrow. We'll take a look at that aspect that has been avoided, which is the leadership question here. Who these folks are, where they have taken this case, and why there are huge problems with their leadership. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.